Was it just a coincidence that last month's successful launching of the insurgency against Syria happened to coincide with the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon? What goals did Turkey have in supporting the overthrow of Assad, and how does it conflict with the goals of the United States and Israel? What have people leaving Syria been saying about the activities of the new regime in Syria, despite their claims to being an improvement over Assad and the al-Qaeda fighters with whom they were once aligned? How will the collapse of Syria affect the wider Middle East region? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we take a special look at post-Assad Syria and its fate with two experts who bring us enlightened and seldom talked about perspectives on who's in charge of the oldest current capital city in the world and the stakes for the country and the region. In our first half hour, Drago Bojnik, the commentator from last week, joins us to talk to us about the role of the U.S. and other foreign powers directing affairs in the West Asian country behind the scenes and why they are doing it. Then in our second half hour, we're joined by Middle East analyst and commentator Laith Maarouf about who the new regime is, what the people crossing the border into Lebanon experienced recently, and how the Middle East stands to be affected by the fall of the once strong supporters of Lebanon against Israel. On this week's program, from the frying pan into the fire, analysis of what is happening in Syria in 2025. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 10th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. After settlers wrenched much of the land from Indigenous people through faulty promises, broken treaties, and force, the settler descendants should address the colonialism and genocides against the Indigenous people which resulted, understand the cost by which their material advantages has been established, and seek to balance with their brothers and sisters through a program of reparations in all its forms. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. CGTN's Zhu Kindu talks with Professor Michel Chossudovsky, Professor Radhika Desai, and Benoit Hardy-Chartrand on the resignation of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the factors which contributed to such decision. That comes under the headline, Video, End of Trudeau Era, Canada's Transition to a New Government, by Professor Michel Chossudovsky, Professor Radhika Desai, Benoit Hardy-Chartrand, and Zhu Kindo. Posted January 9th, original source, CGTN. As a Princeton University survey indicates, our elected officials, especially those in the nation's capital, represent the interests of the rich and powerful rather than the average citizen. We are no longer a representative republic. With big business and big government having fused into a corporate state, the president and his state counterparts, the governors, have become little more than CEOs of the corporate state, which day by day is assuming more government control over our lives. Never before have average Americans had so little say in the workings of their government and even less access to their so-called representatives. Clearly, the year 2025 represents a crossroads. We can passively accept the ongoing erosion of our freedoms, or we can arise to the challenge and defend the principles that have made America great. That comes from the article, Welcome to 2025, Where Your Freedoms Go to Die, by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted January 9th, originally published on the Rutherford Institute. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken admitted to local media that Washington began arming Kiev long before Russia launched its special military operation in Ukraine, thus confirming Moscow's accusations about the direct involvement of the U.S. in the deliberate preparation of an armed conflict with Russia. We made sure that well before the Russian military operation happened, starting in September 2021, and again in December, we quietly got a lot of weapons to Ukraine to make sure that they had in hand what they needed to defend themselves, things like Stingers, Javelins, that were instrumental in preventing Russia from taking Kiev, from rolling over the country, erasing it from the map, and indeed pushing the Russians back, Blinken told the New York Times. He also admitted that despite all the military, economic, and political aid from the United States and the collective West, Kiev is unlikely to be able to, quote-unquote, regain in the near future the territories that have already become part of Russia, Crimea, the People's Republics of Donetsk, Lugansk, and the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Blinken's admission comes only days after the Democrats are set to be replaced by the incoming Trump administration. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has been a vocal critic of the Biden administration's handling of the war in Ukraine, often claiming that it would have never broken out if he had remained president. That comes from the article, quote, "We sent weapons quietly," unquote. Blinken admits U.S. armed Kiev before Russian military operation. Peace was never an option. By Ahmed Adel, posted January 9th, originally published on InfoBricks. "We will end this crime," said RFK Jr., as a comment under a post where an aviation whistleblower spoke about how they are paid big money to spray chemtrails. Kennedy's comment was seen by 4.6 million people, which in itself is raising mass awareness of this crime against humanity. The impact of this short comment of Kennedy is monumental. As long as chemtrails have been sprayed over the world population, it has been labeled a conspiracy theory by the news media, Google, Wikipedia, and others. The insanity of this denial is beyond any reasonable comprehension, as all you have to do is look up and see the indescribable horror of countless planes spraying toxic substances in our skies. That comes from the article, "Carbon is not the enemy. End chemtrails," David Sorensen, by David John Sorensen and Professor Anthony J. Hall, posted January 8th, originally published on Looking Out at the World from Canada. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In Syria, we are looking at the wider implications of the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad from power and the institution of a new regime in power, one that coincidentally is allied with the interests of the U.S. and Israel. We are going to talk to Drago Bojnic on this top subject. Drago is a military and geopolitical analyst and a regular author on Global Research. In December 2024, he received an award for his writings on geopolitical analysis and on nuclear war from the Mexican Press Club. Nice to have you again, Drago. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine.
So the U.S. has clearly taken a stand against Assad for many years, even supporting the terrorist groups from outside the country to pose as Syrian opponents. We've examined all of that on the program in past years. Looking at what happened in late November and December, it took me and a lot of people by surprise. Perhaps you as well. But I thought the war was mostly averted. I suspect it wasn't planned at the spur of the moment. I mean, to whatever extent the US was involved in launching the attack behind the scenes, when do you estimate it was actually planned?
Well, I have to say it was a really unpleasant surprise for me as well, because I really was very supportive of the Assad government, because it was the most civilized government Syria had, and we can see that in the fact that the current government, so to speak, because nobody elected them really, they're just a bunch of terrorists posing as the government. We can see how uncivilized and how, well, savage they are. They're killing minorities. They are essentially suppressing any form of dissent or differing opinions. They are a true dictatorship. So they were saying, the mainstream propaganda machine was kept saying that Assad is an evil dictator and so on. But there was actually more freedom under Assad than there is now in Syria. So the country has essentially been occupied. What the media was calling the Syrian civil war was actually a NATO invasion, NATO Israeli US Turkish invasion of the country. And of course, now since the 7th of December last year, we have a true civil war now, because we have various factions supported by different neighboring powers, and now we will have a true Syrian civil war. There are also resistance groups that don't want these terrorists in power. Many of them, if not most of them, are actually foreign-born. They're not even Syrian. The vast majority of Syrians actually supported Assad, and they voted for him. And I think it was in 2021, the last election, that Assad won. It was a landslide, a victory. So we can see that Syria is essentially now a destroyed nation. It doesn't have any true parameters to be called to even be called a country at this point, because especially after the Israelis have launched hundreds of these massive attacks on the remnants of the Syrian Arab Army, which was the only legitimate armed force of the Syrian state. All these other groups are essentially just rebranded terrorists. Many of them are openly supportive of ISIS. And there were some Western journalists who had to remind these so-called freedom fighters to remove their ISIS patches, because that looks bad on TV. So what we actually see the results of decades of an invasion, of a NATO US NATO invasion that has pretty much destroyed this unfortunate country.
You know, one aspect that seems different from before, in 2015, when the Russians, they rendered assistance to Syria, but this time they're bogged down in the Ukraine war. And I'm wondering, is it true that this was the critical factor in planning out the latest offensive?
Yes, certainly. Certainly, this was an attempt to essentially divert attention, Russia's attention to other hotspots. And the Russians are pushing back in Ukraine, and one of the ways for the U.S. and NATO to slow down the Russian advance in Ukraine is to try to hit these other hotspots. And of course, Syria was a major issue, because the Syrian people were essentially living under a siege and under sanctions for nearly a decade and a half at that point, since 2011 to be specific. So the Russians have military power, but they don't have the financial and economic power of the West to be able to match that. And on the other hand, I've heard rumors. I'm not sure how true this is, but I've heard rumors that Assad was na naively believed the Gulf states. Specifically the Saudi Arabia and UAE and Qatar and these other countries that are allied to the US. And he wanted to establish closer ties with the Arab League, which is pretty much dominated by these US allies. And it seems to me that this has contributed, if maybe it wasn't the main factor, but it was certainly a major contributing factor to the fall of the Assad government. I mean, it's very naive to trust the people who actually invested billions in overthrowing you, in this case, President Assad. So if this is indeed true, I really don't know what he was thinking. On the other hand, I hear also other people saying that the Russians have, left Assad to fend for himself. I'm not sure how true that is, because Assad wasn't only supported by the Russians, there were also the Iranians. So it's a very complex situation, and I think we still don't have, clear data on who actually is responsible for this. But we could say that the real responsibility lies in the US and NATO, because they've been essentially ravaging this unfortunate country for nearly a decade and a half, and the economy was essentially strangled. There was also the earthquake in 2023, if I'm not mistaken. That killed thousands of people and devastated the economic what little economy they had in the Northwest. So essentially, Syria itself came to a breaking point, and of course, the results were catastrophic, as we can see now.
Now, another thing to remember is that the attacks happened within hours of Lebanon establishing a ceasefire with Israel. After Assad was ousted, Israeli forces roared in and annexed the Golan Heights and the territory beyond. And now it appears that Lebanon is weakened as a result. And Israel's getting closer to establishing more of a base in Iran and getting their much dreamed of greater Israel, or that's what Netanyahu is talking about. And Israel, as Putin pointed out, is a clear beneficiary all around. So it seems, first of all, could you maybe answer the question of has Israel already gotten everything that they wanted from this overthrow? And maybe you could also explain a bit about how they are supporting the jihadist groups.
Well, of course, I think they've gotten everything they could have dreamed of, because a sovereign Syria that existed for over half a century is now gone. So after over 50 years of fighting back against Israel, this enemy has been eliminated completely, because these jihadists, they've always been allied to Israel and the US. I remember when I was working for Fortress News, we actually got reports and videos of US and Israeli helicopters transporting ISIS terrorists to Israeli and US hospitals in Iraq. So, doing this, I mean, this alone should be, a question mark for anyone who thinks that the US was ever fighting ISIS in Syria. Also, the interesting thing is the ISIS was the most active in the areas around the Al-Tanf, which is in the southeast of Syria, and that's the area around this base that was essentially occupied by the US. And there would always be these spontaneous, so to speak, rebellions and incursions by ISIS from this area. And every time when the Syrian army would come close to this area, the US would accidentally drop bombs on Syrian soldiers, of course, sending a message that this area is not to be touched. So this is why I'm saying this was an invasion. Unfortunately, it was successful. It showed all of us essentially that the US can do whatever it wants with impunity, essentially, because there were no sanctions, there was nothing to indicate that the US was invading a sovereign country. And of course, this was a crawling invasion, it wasn't officiated, but the point is the US never acknowledged the Assad government and considered Syria to be under his dictatorship, which of course is ludicrous, because there is no basis in international law to simply proclaim governments of any country dictatorships that are illegal. And this is what the US did in Syria, obviously. The issue is Syria is not going to be able to reconstitute itself as a sovereign nation anytime soon, because its military power, which is the basis of the sovereignty of any country, has been destroyed. And even if these resistance groups were to overthrow the terrorists tomorrow, they would still be faced with the US, Turkey, Israel, and these other Western powers that are essentially, or NATO aligned powers that are essentially carving up the country.
We've got to talk about Turkey. Their motive may be at odds with the US and Israel, even though they all work together in a sense to, use their puppets among the jihadists to do their dirty work for them. But what do you think is the preferred end goal for Turkey in supporting the overthrow of Assad by any means necessary?
Well, I think at the center of it is Erdogan's neo-Ottoman project, because Turkey believes it's too small. I mean, he said it a few times that they live in a cage. I think he said a 780,000 kilometers square kilometers cage, which obviously wouldn't be actually a definition of a cage, but still that's how he sees it. He wants Turkey to be much larger. He wants Turkey to have more influence and more power in the region and beyond. So of course this was aligned with the interest of NATO. However, at some point Turkey and Israel might come to a certain crawling clash in Syria. For the time being, I don't see that happening. I only see rhetoric from Erdogan, which is pretty ridiculous, to be honest, because whatever he says is simply just talk. He doesn't walk the walk. He only talks the talk. Turkey is still exporting all the necessities and commodities to Israel. It's supporting Israel, and it has also very close cooperation with the Israeli military. So there's no way for anyone who knows anything about that area to believe that Turkey is an enemy of Israel. We'll see how that goes in the future, because the Neo-Ottoman project clashes with the concept of greater Israel. Because Israel wants to control everything until up until the Euphrates River. And of course, Turkey wants to take at least a third of Syria, if not directly, then at least under some sort of a puppet government. And they already have that thanks to the HTS, which is, of course, as I said, a rebranded ISIS branch.
Well, I'm interested in seeing where these people who have similar aims in terms of overthrowing Assad, but they have, they interest they don't they collide with each other in other ways. For example, Turkey, they're fighting the Kurds, but the U.S. supports the Kurds, and now there's been talk from Erdogan government that they're going to demand that the PKK align themselves with the Syrian government, the new government in Damascus, and you also have to consider that the PKK, if they're attacked, the Turks, as the Erdogan promised, the Islamic State would be freed. That they're in jails that are maintained by the Kurds, or a significant number. So Turkey, the U.S., and Israel may be united in getting Assad overthrown, but their separate motivations lead to separate problems in a post-Assad Syria. So, I mean, how could you? I mean, give me a brief outline of how those potential fractions could damage the entire project.
Well, this is the issue. I don't see the Kurds in any future Syrian government that's going to be backed by Turkey. First of all, it's simply not logical that these people are going to come to terms of any kind, because they've been fighting each other for nearly a decade and a half. And for Turkey, the existence of any Kurdish entity so close to its southern border is unacceptable. And they've said it multiple times. They want to dismantle this SDF-controlled area and give it to the Turkish-backed portions of the new Syrian so-called government. I think we're going to see a lot of problems in that regard in Syria in the future. The only question is how far the U.S. is going to go to support the Kurds, because for the U.S., the Kurds are simply, a tool that was always used whenever it was necessary, whether against Saddam, whether against the Iranians, whether against Assad in previous years. It's not going to be an issue for the U.S. to leave the Turks to fend for them, to leave the Kurds to fend for themselves, because the U.S. will never choose Kurds over Turkey, because Turkey is a major NATO ally. It's the second most powerful conventional power in NATO, and also it hosts U.S. nuclear weapons in the Interlake and several other bases. There are many other installations that NATO needs in Turkey, and also, of course, NATO's power projection in the Middle East is impossible without Turkey, or it would be very difficult at the very least. So I think if push comes to shove, the U.S. is just going to leave the Turks and the Kurds to fight it out. And of course, in that regard, we know who's going to be the winner. The Kurds are very good fighters, but Turkey is far more powerful, has far more resources. I think that the Kurds might try to launch some incursions and some sort of an insurgency that already existed in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. So they can destabilize Turkey in that regard. But other than that, I don't see the Kurds, doing much damage to Turkey. It's only a question, as I said, to how far the U.S. is ready to go to support the Kurds, or at least prevent their total destruction by Turkey.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that in Syria there's what was masquerading as a civil war. Now it really is a civil war. But beyond that, Israel has its goals of expanding southward and engaging Iran. And as they say, the road to Iran goes through Damascus. So could I get your thoughts about whether the what's happened to Syria could lead to ultimately to a war on Iran?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this wasn't just a war against Russia. It was primarily a war against Iran, because Syria was central to the axis of resistance, the so-called Axis of Resistance alliance led by Iran. By neutralizing Syria, they've cut off Hezbollah from Iran, and Hezbollah is another major ally of Iran. It also, this gives the U.S. The possibility to destabilize Iraq, because there are many, many Shia militias, so-called popular mobilization units, PMU, within the Iraqi military, which are loyal to the Iranians, or are allied to the Iranians, just to say the least. And the U.S. wants to neutralize this influence of Iran in Iraq and essentially reoccupy the country. And the best way to do it is to simply allow these terrorists to launch another ISIS-style insurgency in Western and Northwestern Iraq. And of course, this would tie in many of the Iranian forces, and would also force Iran to intervene at some point, maybe, who knows, like they did in 2018, 2019, 2020, and so on. Again, I think for the US, this was like a way to hit two birds with one stone. They wanted to get Russia out of Eastern Mediterranean, and they also wanted to cut off Iran from its allies in Lebanon. So I think this whole ordeal was essentially a part of the war, wider war against Iran. And I think we can see it escalate. And this could be one of the reasons why Iran itself is pursuing nuclear weapons, because they know that nuclear weapons are the ultimate guarantor of sovereignty, because there is no other way for Iran to win against the U.S. And Israel, because both of those countries are nuclear armed, and if Iran isn't, they don't have much of a chance.
Well, Drago, I really appreciate your analysis, and thank you for offering this output. And I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you very much.
Drago Bosnick is a frequent guest on the Global Research NewsHour. He specializes in military and geopolitics, geopolitical analysis, and he joined us from Serbia. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. A month ago, on December 8th, Bashar al-Assad, the former president of Syria and the former commander-in-chief of the Syrian armed forces, fled Damascus to Moscow. This followed 2 weeks of a surprise offensive launched by his armed opposition groups led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. This attack has left HTS effectively as the only authority leading the country, or what's left of it. HTS leader Abu Mohammed al-Julani, according to Al Jazeera, maintained his allegiance to al-Qaeda as recently as 2013. Al-Qaeda is famous for their perceived role in attacking America on September 11, 2001, and thereby triggering the war on terrorism. In 2014, he told Al Jazeera that Syria should be ruled under his group's interpretation of Islamic law, and the country's minorities, such as Christians and Alawis, would not be accommodated. With his background, can we reasonably respect assertions that he is now a woke progressive leader? Is the campaign of liberating Syria about as intact as the campaign of liberating Libya? What role did countries like the US, UK, Israel, and Turkey, with interests of their own, have in bringing the country to its current state? What kind of a future waits for residents of Syria and for the wider region? We're going to discuss this issue now with Laith Maruf, someone I've known for the majority of my career in radio, actually. Laith Maruf is an award-winning journalist and political commentator working in media since 1999. He regularly appears on television and radio, including Radio Sputnik, Press TV, Al Mayadeen. He is also published with independent media such as Electronic Intifada, Mint Press, and more. Previously, Laith worked as the executive director of Community and University Television, or CUTV, and Laith launched and hosted Under the Olive Tree, the Palestinian community radio show airing on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston from 2005 to 2009. Laith derives much of his understanding of the Middle Eastern affairs from his ancestral background of being both of Palestinian and of Syrian extraction. He's currently based in Beirut. Laith, given your background as part Syrian yourself, after more than a decade of the dirty Syrian war, the appearance of the devastation of the Syria that you knew, could you share your thoughts and feelings right now about what you've seen and what has just happened?
Well, it is a shock that I and much of the Syrian people in Syria and around the world are still grappling with. And, you know, there is nostalgia setting in for me, for instance, being Syrian and Palestinian. I feel right now that I have no homeland on both sides. I lived much of my life advocating for the Palestinian people, and that's my mother's side of the family. And I, even with all this advocacy and work and family relation with Palestine, I still felt that I had a homeland in Syria that is still free. And this month, I think I joined the Palestinian people that are fully Palestinian in this sense of detachment from reality and being outside of your homeland, unable to reach it, because I can't go back to Syria right now. There's a fascist government that is there that is targeting any and all criticism, anything that is anti-imperialist, anti-Israeli. And that's not only about people's religious backgrounds. And by the way, just for our listeners to understand, something like 70% of the population of Syria is Muslim, Sunni, but the vast majority of those Muslim Sunnis, like 90% of them, are following the Sufi sects, Sufi schools, meaning mystics. They're not followers of the orthodox schools of the Sunni Islam. And although we hear a lot about rightly so, about the targeting of Alawi shrines and the attacks on Alawi populations and Christian sites. The vast majority of attacks on religious temples is on Muslim Sunni mosques, where HTS thugs are coming in and lynching the Sufi imams and appointing Wahhabi imams. And this is going to be a hard thing for the majority of the population to accept. And we're already seeing responses from people in the neighborhoods when they're coming to their mosques and seeing Wahhabi preachers instead of their beloved Sufi mystic preachers. They're reacting angrily. And a few mosques in Damascus, in the old city, there was scuffles where the parishioners kicked out these Wahhabi preachers. So I'm just throwing that out, just maybe to help everybody understand that the situation in Syria is not about Islam versus other religions. It's about an imported cult, the Wahhabi cult that has been working for the CIA and the Saudi establishment, the Saudi monarchy, to poison all the Muslim countries that are defending themselves against American imperialism.
Now, I thought Assad was winning, and you know, because they with the Russians assisting them, they fought back against this insurgence of I guess, you know, foreign terrorists, basically the cult, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, in late November, in early December, his government totally collapsed. I mean, you know, these guys just came in, and all of the soldiers in place just, you know, dropped their arms, essentially. I mean, didn't even put up a fight, from what I heard. What is your understanding and insights of precisely of the speed by which it suddenly just fell apart? Well, what was going on there?
So the crucial thing that happened is that Russia made a deal with the United States, with the Trump administration, that Russia will get to keep all the territory it captures in Ukraine in return for Russia abandoning Syria and President Assad. And what had happened is that, you know, a few days before the attack on Aleppo, President Assad and his family were invited to Moscow for dinner, and they were never allowed to return. And as you clearly mentioned in the beginning, President Assad is also the chief of staff of the military, commander-in-chief. So with him, the command was taken by the Russians. And what happened on the ground is a coordinated attack by Turkey, Israel, and the Wahhabi death squads. The Syrian military fought outside Aleppo and fought outside Homs and Hama, but every time the confrontations were happening, the Russian communication equipment would be jammed, and then orders for retreat were given. Another thing that everybody should understand is that Syria has been under a one-of-a-kind siege and sanctions, that the country didn't have any more of its resources that are being looted by the United States occupation of the gas, oil, and wheat fields in the northeast, and the occupation of much of its agricultural land and olive oil orchards in the north, in Idlib, that the Turks were looting. So the country had 15 years of sanctions and destruction of the economy, to the point where the salary of a soldier was around $20 a month. And so there was no more, especially after the stagnation of the battlefronts after 2016, and the fact that Syria was not able to take back any of its main sources of income, like the oil fields, gas fields, and what have you, the country lived a total collapse economic, and it, you know, service in the military did not anymore give a patriotic feeling. So you had a demoralized military seeing that the Russians were not allowing Syria to retaliate to the hundreds, if not thousands of attacks by the Israeli Air Force that happened over the last decade. As we saw after the managed collapse of the Syrian military that happened, the first thing the Israelis did was destroy all the caches of weapons that Syria had built up over the last 50 years. And that could not have happened without Russian information on where the equipment are and the ship caches. So this is a deal. It wasn't a military win for Al-Qaeda. It was a managed demolition of the Syrian military and Syrian state between the new colonial powers, the United States, Israel, Turkey, and Russia making the deal over Ukraine.
So there's I saw on Russia Today reports that several people in Syria had fled to the border with Lebanon, you know, clearly afraid of what these terrorist freedom fighter groups were about to do to their country. Laith, what are some of the more shocking details you've heard about what they enjoyed? I mean, this is after the launching of the attack in late November. What are the shocking details you've received about what they all endured in that space of time?
Well, you know, currently as we're speaking, every day there's at least 200 people that are being killed in the streets of Syria. So these are numbers that are equivalent to what was happening in Gaza. And this has been ongoing right now for a month. And the Shia population in the areas around Aleppo, Hama, and Homs have basically been exiled. They were made to march from their villages to Lebanon. Close to 250,000 Shia Syrians crossed the border into Lebanon and were actually gathered in really horrible conditions on the illegal crossing points around the mountain ranges between Syria and Lebanon. The villages in the mountains of the Qalamun that are right on the border. There's also around 12 Lebanese villages that fell in Syrian territory when the French drew the border at the end of 1942, and that lived since then inside Syria, having all their homes and so forth, but having a special a relationship where they are carrying Lebanese citizenship but are allowed to reside permanently in Syria in their villages. These were also marched at gunpoint by HTS into Lebanon. And finally, the areas south and west of Damascus, where the oldest churches in the world are, the areas where people still speak Aramaic, the language spoken by Jesus Christ then at the time. These are like villages like Ma'lula and Saydnaya that have the historic oldest churches in the world. They were also marched at gunpoint, and this area cleared. Nobody knows what happened to the nuns of Ma'lula. Everybody's still trying to figure that out, but clearly nobody in the West cares about them. But the Christian population also in the what is called the Christian Valley in Hama province was also targeted. People were forced to leave their homes. So around 200,000 Christian Syrians crossed into Lebanon in the last month, and these are just the documented numbers. So we're seeing a campaign of population transfers and demographic changes and ethnic cleansing campaigns that we haven't seen the likes of since World War One and World War Two, now being implemented in Syria. And this is, I haven't even spoken yet about the Alawite in the coast and coastal mountain region that have actually are facing the brunt of the mass killings in the streets and the lynchings. And they have responded right now by arming themselves and forming militias and are conducting attacks against HDS. Over the last week, there's been at least five different attacks on HDS commanders and their offices in different parts of the coastal region.
Wow. Yeah. In case you just joined us, listeners, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and we're speaking with our special guest, Laith Maarouf, who's a very apt and knowledgeable commentator on Middle East issues, and including Syria. So, Laith, I've heard that you know, among the targeted groups, I know there is the burning of a Christmas tree on Chris, you know, on around Christmas Day, and there is also a report that when the German foreign minister came to his country, you know, opening up talks for the first time, this guy Al-Jilani refused to shake her hand because of his extreme beliefs or whatever. And that seems to suggest that maybe he's not as woke as people are thinking he is. And this kind of reminds me of the fable about a fox agreeing to swim across a river with a scorpion on his back and then being stung halfway across, dooming them both. And the scorpion explained, "I couldn't help it. It's my nature. I'm a scorpion, you know." So, yes. I mean, for all of his talk about being progressive and woke and everything else, I have doubts about the new Syrian leader's ability to change into, you know, Thomas Jefferson or something overnight. So do you think, you know, I mean, okay, so the leopards generally don't change their spots, but is there any hope that the U.S. or Israel or what have you can rein them in any way over the long term? And if not, what sorts of horrors can you imagine await the people of Syria?
Well, let's be very clear. You know, Israel has moved in on more Syrian territory and occupied a huge part right now of the south of Syria, and is a few kilometers away from the main highway that connects Damascus to Beirut. And in this land grab, they captured the top of Mount Hermon, as it's called in English, or Jabal al-Sheikh in Arabic. And this is the highest point in the Golan Heights, and it was and is Syrian territory. And right beside the peak of Mount Hermon is a cross up there commemorating the visit of Prophet Jesus with his disciples to that location. And the Christian Syrians every year renovate and put the cross there. The Israeli military destroyed it and filmed themselves, the Israeli soldiers, desecrating the shrine. So, no, Israel is in full agreement with the Wahhabis. They're both the fascists. And in fact, it's funny that you brought in the German Nazi foreign minister, the Green Nazi, Baerbock, because it shows you how all of these things are actually play in together. The Wahhabis, the Nazis, and the Zionists are all the frontline attack dogs of imperialism. And here is this supposed icon of women power in Western civilization, who, you know, in Germany, there was an immigrant who received the citizenship, and during his swearing-in ceremony, refused to shake the hand after he already pledged allegiance to Germany and so on, refused to shake the hand of the woman officiating the ceremonies, and the German state you know, denied him citizenship because of that. And if we so seeing this woman, you know, accepting this when it is her own dog, the Zion, you know, the Wahhabi dog that works for the empire. And also another indication of showing you how none of these people actually believe of what they speak, including this Julani. You know, he had, there was multiple videos of a Julani walking in the streets of Damascus over the last month and forcing women to put hijab on, and that he saw with no covering on their heads. But when he met this, his white master, his white Nazi master coming from Germany, this woman with no headscarf, he didn't force her to put a headscarf. Okay. Notice also the Western media who did this. If you remember, Aman Poor from CNN did this stunt where she refused to put the hijab on when she was going to sit down with an Iranian official. And then you notice how now CNN is sending its female journalists putting on hijab when they're talking with HTS. So it shows you how all of this is theatrics. The Germans, the Americans, the Israelis, the Turks, they are in bed with the Wahhabi cult. And this is all being played. And you started your discussion about al-Julani, and I'm sorry that I'm going on a tangent here, by mentioning that he was the leader of al-Qaeda in Syria. Well, he started his career in American you know, jail in Iraq, in Abu Ghraib, with al-Baghdadi. He started before that, before he was captured, he was the second in command of the Islamic State in Iraq, led by al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian, before it became the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And then he was captured and put in, supposedly captured and put into Abu Ghraib with al-Baghdadi. And then they come out together and they start ISIS. And then he splits up and he creates al-Qaeda Syria and becomes second in command of that. And finally rebrands as HTS. These are chameleon contras that change their fatigue and the patch on the side of their shoulder according to what the empire requires them to. And al-Julani is not a Syrian citizen. He is a Saudi citizen who is right now governing Damascus.
Oh, boy. You know, just a few minutes left, but I want to ask where things are going to go from here. I mean, with Syria probably collapsing, just like Libya, just like Iraq or Ukraine even, how does this affect the Middle East chessboard?
Syria is the most important chessboard in all of the Arabic world. And this is not because, I'm not saying it because I'm Syrian. This is what geography tells us and what the history books tells us. What happens on the fields of Syria ends and begins empires in recorded history. The battles that happen in the fields of Syria set the century after them. And what we are witnessing right now is a very similar moment to the combined Crusader invasion of Syria in the 1100s and the Mongol invasion that came simultaneously. And this is what we see, the Crusader invasion from Palestine, which is part of Syria, and combined with a 1-2 punch with the Turkic Mongolic invasion of these Al-Qaeda ISIS types coming from Central Asia, all the way from the Uyghurs to the Uzbeks to the Turkmens and everything in between, a modern Mongol horde, basically. You know, if we look back at the history book from that moment, the lesson would be that it's not going to bode well for any of the invaders.
Got a little bit of time left. Laith, you're the founder of Free Palestine TV. Would you like to take about a minute or so to talk about FPTV, where it airs and what people can do to support it?
Yes, Free Palestine TV. You can find us on our website, freepalestine.video, freepalestine.video, and we are on all social media networks. We are producing on the ground daily reports from the West Bank, from Lebanon, from Jordan. Upwards of 10 reports a day are coming from those locations. We have weekly in-depth shows. One is called Wartime Cafe, where we host personalities in Lebanon in a coffee shop to discuss the latest political issues and the history of those individuals, those personalities that you don't hear in the West, and Prisoners of War, which interviews former Palestinian prisoners of war in the West Bank after their release, and we hear their stories there. We also translate all the military operation videos coming from the Axis of Resistance fronts over the last year. So you can follow us by going to our website, freepalestine.video, check whatever social media platform you like. And we depend on donations and subscriptions from our viewers. We're totally independent, donor-driven. You can subscribe for a monthly donation that will be appreciated. And you can follow us on Patreon and Substack also for subscriptions there.
Laith Maruf, thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we'll connect again in the not too distant future.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Laith Maruf is an award-winning journalist and political commentator. He speaks to us from Beirut.
That's it for this week. Next week, now that he is stepping down as Prime Minister and as leader of the Federal Liberals, we will be bringing you the lowdown around the record of Justin Trudeau and where the party will go from here. Join us in 7 days. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.